So good evening. Tonight is the last evening of our four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. So tonight I will speak about the fourth noble truth, the truth of the Eightfold Path. And just as a little bit of a summary from previous weeks, the Four Noble Truths are the most basic and fundamental teachings that are offered in Buddhism. They encapsulate all of the teachings of the Buddha in these four simple truths: the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And these truths are not put out there as simply metaphysical truths meant to be believed, but are actually meant to be acted on. So the noble truth of suffering is meant to be understood. The cause of suffering is meant to be released or abandoned. The cessation of suffering is meant to be realized. And the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated. So the teachings of the Buddha are very practical. They're not theoretical. They are: put these into action and see what happens in your life. So tonight I'll talk about the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the eight aspects of the path are right understanding or wise understanding, right thought, which can also be called right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So this is a kind of a linear list in some ways, and there is a way in which we progress from one to the other, but at the same time, it really is an eightfold path. They can't be cultivated independently of each other. They really feed off of each other. So, for example, last week I gave an example of if you're cultivating right speech in your practice, if you're working on right speech, then while you're working on that, you're also cultivating the understanding, you're working on cultivating right understanding of what is skillful and what is unskillful speech. And you're cultivating the intention to speak skillfully. So that's wise or right intention. And you're cultivating the effort to increase the wholesome qualities that manifest in right speech, which is right effort. And you're cultivating mindfulness to help you see what you're going to say as you're saying it. So many, many factors come into play as you cultivate any one of these aspects of the path. In fact, you could probably just pick one aspect and focus on it and see all of the others unfold. So I'll go through each of these tonight. So there's a lot to cover in this talk. So I'm going to just speak and hope there's some time at the end for some questions. So one way to look at this Eightfold Path as a linear practice is in the framework that the Buddha often taught for our practice, that moves from ethics, a grounding in ethics, through to a cultivation of the mind and into wisdom. And those components in Pali are called sila, samadhi, panya, which stand for ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So the practice of ethics gives us a grounding in relationships with others that helps to support our ability to concentrate our mind, to focus and to do the meditation, which allows us to cultivate the wisdom that results from the seeing clearly into our experience. So that's the kind of basic way that it unfolds. And the Eightfold Path fits into this framework. The aspect of sila or ethics is comprised of the factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The concentration aspect is comprised of the factors right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the wisdom aspect is comprised of right understanding and right intention. So the path ends with the wisdom aspects of right understanding and right intention. And yet those two aspects, right understanding and right intention, are typically listed as the first two factors of the path. So that gives us some indication that we actually have to have a little bit of wisdom to get onto the path to begin with. So I'll start there. I'll start with talking about how we actually begin a practice. So most people start a spiritual practice through some contact with suffering. It seems that many, many people come to a spiritual practice when they see something in their lives that's difficult to understand, difficult to deal with, and they feel there has to be another way. In my own life, that is what happened. I had such a deep contact with suffering, I just felt like there's got to be another way to live my life. And fortunately, at that moment, I also heard some of the teachings, these liberating teachings of the Buddha. And that is what got me onto the path. The Buddha said we come to a spiritual practice when we encounter suffering, and that suffering leads us either to bewilderment or search. So hopefully the fact that you're all here means that you are all searching, and that some of these teachings can help to clarify some of the confusion that may be around how can I live my life in another way. So this is the beginning of right understanding, this contact with suffering, in this sense that there's got to be something else. So it contains in it the seeds of intention to do something different, to change our way of dealing with the world. Now those intentions, when we contact suffering like that, they're not always so wholesome and pure as to put us on a spiritual path. I mean, any look in the newspaper in the morning shows us the wide variety of responses that people have to suffering, many of them very unskillful. But when our encounter with suffering helps us to understand the common bond that we have with humanity and leads to an inclination to end our own suffering, but not at the expense of others, then we have the seeds of right intention. So the initial stirrings of right understanding and right intention are what motivate us to begin a spiritual practice in the first place. But our understanding of them initially is incomplete, because the full fruition of right understanding and right intention comes when the mind is fully released from all the suffering, from greed, aversion, and delusion. So the path of practice clarifies this over time. It's kind of like a spiral that as we go through the practices, we clarify our intention and our understanding a little more deeply as we practice, as we meditate, as we work with our ethics in relations with others. These understandings and intentions also become clearer. So one place to begin our path of practice is within our relationship to the world, how we get along with other people. It's helpful to start a spiritual practice from a base where our relationships with others are based in compassion and honorable behavior. So this is not necessarily, at least from the Buddhist perspective, this isn't necessarily for reasons of morality. I should do this because it's right, or I shouldn't do this because it's wrong. Rather, the motivation for ethics in this practice is to cultivate clarity of mind and compassion. So when we start paying attention to our actions, we begin to see what actions lead us into suffering and distress, and what actions cause suffering to others, and what actions lead us away from that. So we begin to learn ourselves through observing our actions, how we can more skillfully be in the world. And this will lead to more clarity in our minds. So for just a simple example, I think I mentioned last week an example of how you might, how your mind might function if you had lied to a friend. You know, if you've told a lie to somebody, then the mind kind of gets unsettled around that, thinking, oh, I told that person that thing, and that person knows that person. I better make sure that person either knows that I told that person, or I tell the same person that thing too. And your mind can kind of get really unsettled and restless around this issue of having lied to someone. The worry that they might find out, how will they respond if they find out? There's all kinds of ramifications of having done that. So that leads away from clarity of mind into restlessness and confusion of mind. So it's just very simple. The ethics in Buddhist practice are very simple, looking at what is skillful and helpful towards clarity of mind and what is unskillful towards that, and avoiding the unskillful, cultivating the skillful. So as we begin to cultivate this understanding of what's skillful and unskillful, we actually start to see that what is skillful for us and helpful for us is actually turns out to be helpful for others, and what's helpful for others turns out to be helpful for us. So it's not so much of a distinction as we really start to pay attention to our actions. There's not so much of a distinction between self and other. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, as I mentioned, the aspects of ethics are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And I'll go into those, each one. So speech is one of the main ways that we interact with the world, and it really can have a huge impact on our lives. I'm sure that most of you have had the experience of having said something just out of a mood or a rashness and then regretted it later. A feeling of, oh, I really wish I hadn't done that. I wish I had seen what the consequences of that would be before I said it. Gill likes to call right speech mindfulness out loud. And it's a really good way to look at right speech, that if we can bring mindfulness to our speech, we have a chance to observe the impact of our speech, how it will impact ourselves and others, if we can observe what we're going to say before we say it. One of the monks that comes here at times to teach, and he'll actually be coming at the end of this month, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, called Tan Jeff more familiarly, he likes to say that he tells the story that his teacher says about right speech. If you can't control your mouth, you don't have any hope for being able to control your mind. And that's also a nice way to look at right speech, that it's a great way to bring us into mindfulness and observing in our minds. But right speech can be a pretty challenging practice. Most of the time, or much of the time, we speak really without even being aware that we're going to speak, much less know what we're going to say or think about the impact it's going to have on somebody that we're going to say it to. So a great thing to try at times, if you can remember, is to just pause before you speak. If you can even just remembering to pause is challenging. But if you can remember that, if you can remember to pause before you speak, you'll probably get to see, you'll know what you're going to say before you say it. And you'll have a chance to observe why. You may get to see why you're going to say that thing. What's your intention behind saying it? It may be spoken out of love and compassion. It may be spoken out of frustration and anger. So there is always an intention behind speech. So if we have that moment of pausing, we have an opportunity to see what we're going to say and why we're going to say it. And in that moment, we have the choice. Sometimes we can actually have the choice, not always. Sometimes the momentum of whatever is happening is so strong, all we can do is just witness the fact that, oh, we're going to say this thing, and it just comes out. But sometimes if we make that opportunity to pause, we have a chance to have a choice about whether we actually speak, and to choose, oh, well, this motivation here seems to be skillful. I think I will say this thing. Or this motivation, maybe I should hold off on saying this until I really clarified why I want to say this. So the Buddha provided some guidelines for us about how to cultivate right speech, and he provided a list of four types of speech to avoid. He suggested that we avoid false speech, so anything that's untrue should be avoided. Divisive speech, any kind of speech that divides us from each other, to set one group of people apart from another group of people, or one person apart from another person. Any kind of abusive or harsh speech designed to lash out or hurt someone. And any kind of idle chatter. So our task is not so much to blindly follow these as rules, but to simply notice with mindfulness, use them as guidelines, kind of mindfulness bells to recognize, oh, I'm getting ready to say something harsh. You know, what is my motivation here? What is happening? So to really use it as a way to observe our intention and what's happening in our minds at the time. So there can be some gray areas I've noticed in my own life and practice, particularly for myself, around idle chatter. This particular area, I've wondered, you know, well, is it really to be completely avoided? Because it seems like in our culture, we use that kind of what seems to be meaningless chatter to form a bond and a connection. It actually has a meaning. That while on the surface it seems like we're just chatting about the weather or some movie we saw yesterday, there's a way in which it's serving to connect us. And so I look at my intention. Is my intention to just fritter away time, or is it serving to bring a connection between me and the other person? So it really is an exploration of intention in looking at these things, not to just follow these things blindly. So aside from those four types of speech to avoid, the Buddha also had some suggestions about how to decide whether to say something, if it follows those criteria. If something is true, and it's not harsh, and it's not divisive, and it's not idle chatter, he doesn't always say we should say it. And he doesn't necessarily suggest that we should avoid anything that people might not want to hear, but he has some suggestions for us about things to look at in order to make that decision. If I'm going to say something that's going to be hard for somebody to hear, how do I decide whether to say it? And he suggests checking to see, is it beneficial? Is this something that the other person, it would be beneficial for the other person to hear? And the other one, is it a proper time for speaking about this topic? And by that, I take it to mean to consider the situation that we're in. Are we getting ready to rush off to a meeting? Is it better if we have a little more time for this to unfold? Who are the people present? Is it appropriate for all the people in the room to hear this topic? Considerations like that. What's the context this is being spoken in, and is it the right time? It might also be a consideration of what the state of mind of the other person is, or the state of mind that you're in. If you're in a state where you feel like there's something that needs to be communicated, but there's a little bit of anger around it, there may be a need or it may be helpful to wait until you've cooled off a little bit before you say it, so that there's not that edge that could make the other person defensive and not be able to hear what you're saying. Or perhaps the other person may not be in the state or space to be able to hear what you're saying, that you need to wait until they've come to a place in their life where they can actually hear what you have to say. So there are many, many considerations around right speech, and I've really only touched the tips of the waves. But I'm going to move on now to right action. Right action is still within the sphere of our relationship to others, and it reminds us to be aware of how we use our bodies in relationship to the world. And as with right speech, the Buddha talked about right action in terms of actions to avoid as opposed to actions to actually do. He puts it in the negative. These are things we should avoid. And he says we should avoid killing, we should avoid stealing, and we should avoid sexual misconduct. So some of the Buddhist teachings that talk about right action stress again the intention. Intention's a really crucial point around the ethics of the Buddhist ethics. They really stress the intention behind the action. And in some ways, the aspects of right action could be phrased as refraining from the intention to kill, or from following through on the intention to kill, refraining from the intention to steal, or from following through on the intention to steal, refraining from the intention for sexual misconduct, or from following through on the intention for sexual misconduct. Now, maybe this seems like a fine point, but consider the following example. You're walking across a lawn and you step on a spider, and the spider dies. Or you see a spider on your wall in your house and you pick up a shoe and kill it. So in both situations, an action that you've taken has resulted in the death of the spider. But the mind in the two cases is completely different. In the first case, there's no intention to kill. In fact, you may not even be aware that a spider has died. In the second case, there's an intention to kill the spider and you follow through on it. So the second one would probably not be considered right action. But again, it depends on the motivation. If it's a black widow spider hanging over your baby's crib and you need to kill it quickly, it may be right action. If you're acting out of a hatred for spiders and it's just peacefully sitting there on the wall, there may be a way in which you could scoop it up and take it outside instead. So it's really the intention behind it that determines whether or not it's skillful or unskillful, a skillful or unskillful action. I think this teaching also points out to us that the action, right action or wise action, is not compromised while we're still struggling with some of these tendencies, these habits of mind to hate spiders and want to lash out at people when we're angry. These tendencies of mind are there. So we have to work with those intentions. We have to be able to witness them. We can't just cut them off and say, they're not good to have in my life. You know, the classic, you know, I've lusted in my heart, therefore I've sinned. You know, that is not the way that it's viewed in this teaching. But if you can refrain from acting out of that intention and simply observe it, it's also right action. So it provides a little more openness and spaciousness around the difficulties that we face in dealing with some of these hard, difficult mind states we have. So I think I'm not going to go into too much detail on right action so that I have a little more time on some of the other areas. So I think I'll just move on now to right livelihood. Now, the spirit of right livelihood is finding work or livelihood where right speech and right action are not compromised. That's the essence of it. The Buddha did give some specific occupations that should be avoided, such as dealing in weapons, trading in human beings, which would include prostitution and slavery, trading in alcohol and drugs. Those kinds of things, he said, we should not be concerned with. But really, in our day and age, there's so many kinds of occupations, we really, again, have to look at our motivation, our intention about what we're doing and why we're doing it, and to see if we're required in our jobs to break any of these precepts or suggestions that the Buddha said about lying and killing and stealing. So, for example, Gill tells a story where somebody came up to him and was expressing some disturbance because as a salesperson he was required to lie in his job. And he was looking for some way in which he could still practice the path and keep his job. And Gill just had to say, you've got to find a way to not lie in your life. You know, it's just not skillful to do that. So if you find yourself in that kind of a situation, you may really want to consider if that's the kind of livelihood you want to pursue. Again, with the other aspects of ethical conduct, there are some gray areas. And intention is the crucial piece to look at here. So there's so many things that are kind of neutral out there, like computers are neutral. They can be used to further advancements of science and understanding of health, and they can be used to wage war. So we really need to look at our intention if we're involved in a field where there's some ambiguity about how the thing we're doing is used. What is our intention? Is our intention to increase the understanding and compassion and connection between people? Or is our intention more selfish? You know, oh, I just want to make as much money as I can, so I'm going to get as many contracts as I can from these defense contractors or something like that. So it really is, again, comes back to our intention and not so much to the actual occupation. So as we train in these aspects of sila, of right speech, right action, right livelihood, our sense and understanding of what causes ourself and others harm begins to clarify. And we observe from our actions and our motivations what helps us to move away from suffering, what helps us towards freedom. So as we experience more and more the benefits of the skillful intentions and the skillful actions, we more often will choose the road that leads there. As we cultivate harmony in our relationships with others, our mind becomes happier and more peaceful. Living our lives, our outer lives, with the intention of compassion and peacefulness has a kind of a rebound effect on our inner life. That intention, that mind of choosing to act skillfully really rebounds on our inner life and helps us to cultivate the stillness and quietness and wholesome qualities of mind. So this part of the path we're moving into now is the path of cultivating the development of mind. And this is the samadhi aspect of the Eightfold Path, or concentration. And the three aspects of this are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So cultivating right speech, right action, and right livelihood, we gain appreciation for those actions and qualities of mind that lead us away from suffering and towards happiness and peace. We see the benefit of making effort in this direction, and it does take effort to do that. Anyone who's tried to keep a New Year's resolution will know how hard it is to resolve And to keep that resolve, we have to keep that resolve going over and over again. We can't just make it at New Year's and say that's it and hang our hat on that and say we will cultivate that, we'll do that. We have to continually do that cultivation of that resolve over and over again. And this is the basis of right effort, which takes as its foundation an understanding of what's wholesome or skillful and what is unwholesome or unskillful. So while right speech, right action, and right livelihood help us to cultivate skillful actions in the world, right effort helps us to cultivate wholesome qualities of mind. So the simplest definition I know of for wholesome qualities of mind are those that are not based in greed, aversion, and delusion. So those are qualities like joy, happiness, peace, tranquility, equanimity, generosity, kindness. Unwholesome states of mind are those based on greed, aversion, and delusion, and those are the ones that lead us into suffering, such as anger, sloth, restlessness, frustration, despair, aversion, lust for power or money. So right effort, there are four kinds of right effort, and these sound a little technical, but I'll read them out first and then I'll go through them. So the first one is the effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. I'll explain that in a minute. The second one is the effort towards the abandoning of unwholesome states that have arisen. The third is the effort towards the arousal of wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And the fourth is the effort towards the sustaining of wholesome states that have arisen. So the first, the effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. Basically, I mean, that sounds kind of obscure. There's so many negatives in there, it's hard to wrap your mind around it. But basically what it means is observing through our experience what actions and states of mind lead us into suffering and refraining from them. So, for example, perhaps we know from experience that getting into a political conversation with a certain person just leads to contention and strife. So we can, one way of avoiding the non-arising of that strife, to avoid the arising of that strife, is to just not go there with that person. So with my parents, I just avoid political conversations. It's just, there's no point to it. Or if you want to go there, if you want to begin to make some inroads into those conversations that are difficult, to do it in small steps, to see as the difficult mind states begin and then back off. So to really pay attention to how difficult it is and respect at times that it's helpful to avoid situations where you know something difficult mind states are going to arise. Now, it's not always skillful to avoid these things because sometimes it's helpful to challenge ourselves about what our edges are. But just know that it is part of the path to avoid some situations that lead you into difficult mind states. So the second kind of right effort is the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. And this means that when we notice we're caught up in something, when we're actually already caught up in some kind of anger or aversion or grasping at something, that we make an effort to let go of it. We make an effort to abandon unwholesome states that have arisen. So this letting go can have an active quality, such as, you notice that unwholesomeness and just say, I really want to let go of that and make an active effort to let go of it. But sometimes that letting go can also simply be bringing mindfulness to it, to just observe that unwholesome or difficult mind state and not act on it. That also is letting go. It is a form of letting go, to simply observe with non-judgmental attention that anger or that frustration, to let it live out its life and let go on its own. With patience, we'll see that the mind will let go of these things through mindfulness. The third kind of right effort is the effort to arouse wholesome states that have not arisen. So this is those qualities of mind that we'd like to cultivate: joy, loving kindness, tranquility, equanimity. We make efforts to put ourselves into situations that cultivate those qualities. The act of sitting down in meditation is one of those actions, putting ourselves into a situation where we are attempting to cultivate wholesome qualities of mind. Metta, for example, the metta practice, is a way to cultivate loving kindness, very actively to cultivate loving kindness, to consciously think phrases of goodwill towards yourself and others will begin to generate those qualities of mind for you. So we can try to cultivate qualities of mind through this positive action, and we can also cultivate positive qualities of mind through abstaining from unwholesome actions. So, for instance, all of the actions to avoid in right speech and right action, when you do those, when you refrain from lying, you are correspondingly cultivating truthfulness. So there's a kind of a reciprocal nature to those acts of avoidance, that they have the benefit of cultivating positive qualities of mind as well. The fourth kind of right effort is the effort to sustain wholesome mind states that have arisen. And this may sound a little odd. I mean, it seems like if something wholesome has arisen, it seems like it would just be natural to want to sustain it. But in my experience, actually, sometimes it does take effort to sustain wholesome qualities of mind. When joy and happiness arise, sometimes the mind doesn't particularly want to go there. I mean, my mind, surprisingly, is that way. I was kind of shocked when I saw that I would get to some very peaceful and calm states, and then the mind would kind of go, oh, well, that's nice, but I've got all these things I need to do. You know, so it's like it just wanted to jump away from that calm and peace. So one way to cultivate the wholesome qualities of mind when they have arisen is to simply appreciate them, to really let yourself be mindful of them, to pay attention to them, to let yourself really appreciate what it feels like to have qualities of generosity, of happiness, of calm in your life. Don't run away from them by busying yourself, thinking that I've got more important things to do. That's a pretty common movement of mind as we start to experience some of the peace and tranquility in meditation. It's like, okay, well, now I can do all these things, or I can see all the things I need to do clearly now. So our cultivation of right effort has ramification in our daily lives, and it also has ramification in our meditation. As I said earlier, the act of sitting down to meditate itself is right effort. We're intending to cultivate the wholesome qualities of mindfulness and concentration when we sit down to meditate. One of my teachers in Burma, Sayadaw Upandita, talks about launching effort, that effort to get you to the cushion. And then he talks about sustaining effort, the effort to stay there and keep coming back over and over and over again. Over and over again, we come back to our object of attention, to cultivating the qualities of mindfulness, concentration, and all of the wholesome qualities that will follow in their wake. So as we cultivate right effort, we really start to see the value of mindfulness. And in fact, in terms of cultivating wholesome mind states, one quality above all is worth cultivating, and that is mindfulness. Sometimes people think about cultivating mindfulness kind of sits in opposition to right effort, because in mindfulness we are sort of told to let things be, and in right effort we're very clearly looking at what's wholesome, how can I cultivate the wholesome, what's unskillful, how can I avoid it. But I just like to point out that mindfulness actually contains the right efforts in it. That if you... mindfulness has this kind of magic quality. It seems magic, but actually, if you understand the mechanisms, it makes a lot of sense. But it seems magic when you bring your mind, when you bring mindfulness to a wholesome or skillful quality, it increases the chances, it increases the conditions for it to arise more in the future. And when you bring your attention, your mindfulness, to an unwholesome quality of mind, it creates the conditions in the future for it to arise less often. It's as if the wholesome qualities of mind bask in the warmth and the attention of mindfulness, and the unwholesome qualities shrink from the clarity and brightness of mindfulness. And the way this works, the way I understand that this works, is that as we actually witness the wholesome qualities with mindfulness, we witness the beneficial results of that. And as we witness with mindfulness the unwholesome qualities, we really feel the suffering. And the mind knows that suffering is not what it wants. A good definition for mindfulness might be a quality of non-judgmental attention to what is happening while it's happening. And that while it's happening piece is crucial in the definition or in the experience of mindfulness. Awareness happens all the time. It's continually happening. Even if you're not mindful, there's some form of awareness happening in your life. So I'm sure you've experienced the kind of thing where, you know, suppose you're reading a book or something and somebody walks into the room and does something and then leaves. You may know if somebody tells you later, if somebody asks you later what happened when you were reading a book, you can probably tell them that somebody came in the room and left. But you really weren't attentive to that experience. So there was awareness of it, but the awareness of it wasn't right in sync with the experience itself. So the mindfulness brings the attention into sync. It makes our attention synchronous with the experience. And mindfulness has a kind of a brightness and a clarity to it that becomes obvious once we know what it feels like, or once we become familiar with it. And one of the best ways that I know of to get familiar with what that actually feels like is that moment when we recognize we've been gone, when we wake up, when we recognize, oh, I've been lost in thought. That moment is a moment of mindfulness. And I suggested this in the guided meditation. I don't know if any of you were able to do it, but it is a moment of mindfulness. And if you can notice in that moment, there's a very clear, you have the opportunity to see the difference between what it feels like to be lost, because there's an awareness, a subtle awareness going on when you're lost in thought. And you can kind of feel what that cloudiness feels like. And you can feel the clarity of what it feels like to be awake again. It's the best place I know of to really begin to understand what that felt sense of awake is. So I really encourage you to look at that moment. It's a prime moment of mindfulness. It's completely unprompted. It comes out of the blue. You didn't intend to do it. It happened. It was a spontaneous moment of mindfulness that you woke up and realized, I was lost in thought. And it's a pure moment of mindfulness that is effortless. So it's a real great leader for us to begin to really understand what mindfulness is about. So if we know that that's a great moment to pay attention to, it can really help us to let go of the tendency to judge ourselves for having been lost, which we typically will do when we've been lost in mindfulness. We'll often think, oh, I've been so bad, I'm not a good meditator, I don't know how to do this, and we've lost it. We've lost that moment of clarity as soon as we start to judge ourselves for it. But if we can use that moment to see if you can recognize, what is it like now that I'm present again? It can help to cut through a lot of that judgment. And that judgment is completely extra. It's completely unnecessary. Minds wander. It's just what they do. They come back, we pay attention. They wander, they come back, we pay attention. Probably the hardest thing about mindfulness is remembering to do it. In fact, the Pali term for mindfulness, sati, the root of that is memory. The word for that in Pali, the root word for that in Pali means memory. So a lot of the aspect of mindfulness is simply to remember to do it. So I like to find ways to help myself to remember to do it. And I've got a few things that I've worked with. I'll just throw them out as suggestions for you. I like, in my daily life, I find daily life to be a great place to cultivate mindfulness, and it's incredibly supportive of our meditation practice. If we don't simply relegate the cultivation of mindfulness to sitting on the meditation cushion, but to find ways that we can bring mindfulness into our daily life. The thing that I found most helpful along these lines is to pick a couple of things to try to remember to pay attention to. Don't go and say, okay, I'm going to be mindful all day long, because you're just going to set yourself up and you're not going to be able to do it. So just pick a couple of things, like the sound of the telephone. Use that as a mindfulness bell, as a way to remember, oh, pay attention now. For a while when I did this practice, I got this from Thich Nhat Hanh, for this suggestion of paying attention to the telephone. For a while, I was letting the phone ring 3 times before I picked it up, and just paying attention to my breath while the phone rang, and then I'd pick up the phone. And it had the benefit that I was present for the person on the other end of the phone when I actually picked up the phone. So that was one thing I used. Or you can use other common events, like walking into a room. You've gone into a new space. You know, it can sometimes help to trigger you to remember to pay attention because there's a new space that you're in. Just pick one or two events during a week and see if you can bring mindfulness to them. And know that, at least when I started doing this, what typically happened is, with the telephone, for example, I didn't remember the first time the phone rang. You know, I just picked it up. But then I remembered some. Maybe it was hours later. Maybe the phone had rung 5 times before I remembered, oh, I was supposed to be paying attention when the phone rang. I was supposed to let the phone ring and just be mindful. That first recognition, oh, I haven't remembered, that's the beginning of the mindfulness. So don't let yourself think, I can't do this now. That's where it starts. That's where it begins. So just recommit yourself. Try it again. Okay, I'm going to try again. The next time the phone rings, I'm going to try to remember. And maybe you remember, maybe you don't. But my experience of this was that the remembering of, oh, I'm supposed to pay attention when the phone rings, kind of successively got closer and closer to the event. It would be, you know, instead of being hours after I'd had several phone calls, it would be just after I put the phone down. Oh, I forgot. And then it got to the point where the mindfulness was there when the phone rang, and I could let it. It can take days to let this process unfold. So it really just takes the recommitment of, I'm going to try it again. I'm going to try it again, just over and over. So we've been talking quite a lot about mindfulness in the last few weeks, and it's a crucial part of the Four Noble Truths. It's a crucial part of the path of practice. Mindfulness is kind of the cutting edge. If we're mindful everything flows from there. All the other wholesome qualities will flow from there. We use mindfulness so that we can understand suffering. We use mindfulness so that we can see the cause of suffering. We use mindfulness so that we can realize the cessation of suffering. And we use mindfulness to help us cultivate the qualities of heart and mind that lead to the cessation of suffering. So the cultivation of mindfulness aids us in the cultivation of concentration. And this is the next aspect of the Eightfold Path, right concentration. So most forms of meditation fall into two kinds of categories, either concentration practices or awareness practices. And concentration practices use a kind of a one-pointed focus on an object to still and calm the mind. You can use many objects for this, but basically you pick an object and you just let go of everything else. Let your mind just keep coming back there. Using the breath, you can do this. You can just say, I'm just going to pay attention to the breath. If anything happens, I'm just going to come back to the breath. Other common objects are, in Tibetan practices, they use mandalas or mantras. You can use the phrases of metta as a way to absorb into loving kindness. So there's many, many ways to cultivate concentration. But the key about the concentration is that the mind becomes absorbed into the object of meditation. It becomes oblivious to everything else, very, very still, very quiet. Concentration is a very healing practice. It creates very wholesome qualities of mind and body. Mindfulness practices or awareness practices help us to cultivate that non-judgmental awareness of what's happening while it's happening. In the instructions for mindfulness practice that we give here, we typically suggest that people start out with a focus on something like the breath, and then as the mind stabilizes and steadies, that we open up to other objects that become predominant in our experience, so that the meditation can proceed. You start with the breath, and then perhaps a sound occurs, and you go to the sound, and then a sensation in the body, and you let that be the focus of your attention. So that the awareness practices cultivate a flow of awareness on a changing stream of objects. So both forms of meditation bring mindfulness and concentration into play. It's just that they're kind of different balances of them in the two types of practices. In concentration practices, we need mindfulness to let us know when we've slipped off of the object and bring it back. So it's a very simple kind of mindfulness. It's just breath, not breath, breath, not breath. That's all you really need to distinguish in a concentration practice on the breath. In an awareness practice, if we're primarily doing an awareness practice, the concentration provides the stability of mind to stay present for the ever-changing flow of events that are happening. It steadies the mind so it can look at that change, a sight, a sound, a pain, a mood in that flow of experience. And it also gives us some focus so that we can see, look more deeply into what's actually happening, looking into the changing nature of the experience. Mindfulness and concentration are not rarefied, obscure states of mind. They are very common, ordinary states of mind. They just are usually not cultivated to the degree in which we cultivate them in meditation. So in our normal waking consciousness, these operate all the time. If you've ever gotten to the place where you're reading a book and you don't notice that somebody's come into the room and you kind of get startled when you see them, that's concentration. You're kind of absorbed into the book. Or if you put your hand in hot water and notice that it's hot, it's like that's mindfulness. You know it's hot while it's happening. These moments of mindfulness and concentration happen throughout our day. We have a moment of mindfulness, we recognize an experience, and then we have a stream of thoughts about it and plans and activities and remembrances about it. But that moment, it was there. There was a moment of mindfulness. So really in the practice that we're doing here, we're trying to cultivate a steadiness of mindfulness so that there's more mindfulness in our day, more concentration in our day. But we're not trying to develop something other. It's really just qualities of mind that we are already familiar with. Concentration and mindfulness together really can help us to penetrate very deeply into the nature of reality, into the nature of our minds. And both need to be cultivated quite strongly to that continuous kind of nature in order for insight to arise. And when it does, it provides the springboard into wisdom, which is the next aspect of the Eightfold Path. And this is comprised of right understanding and right intention. So the most basic definition of right intention is the full understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So it really it's kind of circular here. It contains the Four Noble Truths within it. As we practice the Eightfold Path, we begin to get clearer and clearer about our suffering and what the causes of suffering are and how we can be released from suffering. And when we understand that deeply, right understanding is the result of that, a full understanding of the end of suffering. The manifestation of that is a mind that is free from greed, aversion, and delusion. And out of that mind, free of greed, aversion, and delusion, the intentions of action and speech are naturally pure. So the ending of the path kind of begins and ends with these qualities of right understanding and right intention. The fruition of the path is that the intentions are naturally pure. So the culmination of the path is right understanding, and its manifestation in our lives is right intention. So I took all of the time. It's 9 o'clock. I just wanted to let you know that if you need to leave, please go ahead and leave. But I would like to just open it up if anybody has a couple of questions. We can stay for a few minutes.
Does it ever help to look into the past? Like, let's say you said something and then you regret it, and then you ask, like, oh, no, I wasn't mindful. Does it ever help to analyze the past and to think what state of mind you were in?
No, it's definitely helpful. We have to use reflection. In fact, the Buddha gave a whole teaching on reflection that, you know, doing an action, we should reflect while we're doing it. Is this helpful? Is this skillful? After we've done the action, we should reflect. He suggests reflecting before, during, and after. So before we do the action, reflect, will this be helpful? During the action, reflect, is it skillful? After the action, look back and see if it was, what happened? And definitely, you know, that's how we learn. We definitely need to look at the past and see, well, that wasn't so skillful, you know, what can I do differently, and how can I cultivate the situation where that might not happen again? So definitely, yeah.
Is it possible to be mindful and look in the past? You know, like, so you're walking around, you're doing something, but you're thinking about the past, but the present moment is here. Right?
Yes, well, you know, thinking about the past is something that's happening in the present moment. It's possible to be aware that you're thinking about the past, so it's possible to be mindful of that. It's challenging to actually think mindfully, but it's possible. And that kind of reflection, you know, sometimes it can be helpful to do it in a very meditative way so that it can be a little more, so that you don't get caught in the story of it, but that you really, you know, let yourself reflect body and mind about the experience. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Kind of touching on that a little bit, Andrea, when we were in Chesmont at the monastery, I was reflecting about the past in terms of when I was 13 and started smoking. And even though we were taught to stay present, what I realized when I turned 16, I had this terrible cold, sore throat, and I was smoking. And I'm sort of like, what am I doing? My throat was on fire. And it was that clear insight that I had mistaken simply as willpower that really helped me make a change before I even knew what Buddhism was.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think that points to the fact that that change really has to happen in the present moment. You know, that we really need to see it clearly. It can be harder to make a change simply by thinking, I should make that change. So, yeah, I think your experience kind of points to that. Thank you. So I don't want to keep you too much longer. So I really enjoyed these past 4 weeks, and I've really appreciated being here and sharing this with you. So thank you for your attention and your participation.